If you have a serious allergy, you know that having an EpiPen on hand can literally be a lifesaver. The problem is that prices have skyrocketed.
Last time we refilled his EpiPen, his prescription cost us $370, and that was after the $100 coupon provided by the manufacturer.
We'll speak with that family, a doctor, and the lawmaker behind a new bill to help fire and rescue departments save thousands of dollars a year on the drug. But first, we delve into craft beer.
Nobody really asks calories anymore. That was what people asked in the 80s. It'd be like if all there was white wine, red wine, and import wine.
That's Virtue Cider's Greg Hall. We talk to the former brewmaster at Goose Island about his new venture and speak with a Central Illinois brewer. What's your favorite Illinois craft beer? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If it seems like everywhere you look these days, you find a craft brewer, you know, you're probably right. The number of craft breweries in Illinois has tripled over the past 4 years. There are 157 now throughout the state. According to the Brewers Association, Illinois actually is the 10th highest number of craft breweries throughout the country. That's going all the way from Chicago and its suburbs down to southern Illinois near Carbondale. The average American lives within 10 miles of a brewery, which also includes tap rooms, big and small, and brew pubs where good food has become part of a proper drinking experience. We're going to be talking about that today on the 21st, the craft brew scene throughout Illinois. If you have suggestions, we've been talking to you guys on social media about this for the past 24 hours, of your favorite craft beer to drink in Illinois, you can chime in. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. If you follow 21st Show, we just tweeted out a lovely beer graphic with all of the suggestions you guys have already made. I want to welcome Greg Hall to the 21st right now. He's seen all of this unfold in Chicago, where he worked alongside his father, the founder of Goose Island Brewing Company. He was brewmaster there until 2011. He's now the co-founder and CEO of Virtue Cider in Fenville, Michigan, and he joins us from there on the phone. Hey, Greg, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nayla. How are you doing?
I'm good. Greg, so you were 22 when your dad started Goose Island. You've described those days, this is in the 80s, as the Wild West of craft brewing. How so?
Well, there was no infrastructure. There was, it was all new to people. Back then, most drinkers thought there were three kinds of beer, regular beer, light beer, and import beer. And that was about it. Styles like pale ale or IPA, not to mention Goza or different varieties, were unheard of back then. So it was, we had actually less credibility being a local brewer when we first started Goose Island. People thought that we were not as professional because we were just home brewers. But all that has changed for the better, I think.
Yeah. What was the idea behind why Goose Island was started?
Well, my father had been in the corporate world and traveled all over Europe and the Pacific Rim for work. And everywhere he went, he drank the local beer. And then he came back to Chicago, where everyone he knew drank beer, but there was no local beer. Back then, Old Style was the local beer, and that came from like 5-6 hours away. So he thought it was kind of odd and a huge opportunity, because Chicagoans are so loyal to do a local beer in Chicago. So we opened Goose Island in 1988. Never had any dreams of getting as big as Goose Island is now.
Greg, I have to say, our producers are gagging in the control room when you said Old Style. We're getting a lot of faces. I know that people have nostalgia for Old Style. When did you think things started to shift? When did you see the movement for craft beer? Goose Island certainly, I mean, I think has been at the forefront of that for Illinois and, you know, for parts of the country. When did you start to see that movement of people saying, hey, this is something that's really important to us?
Well, in the, we certainly had some real loyal people in the early days. We had the Chicago Beer Society, guys like Randy Mosher and Ray Daniels, who have gone on to bigger and better things themselves in the beer industry, and many others who would come to the brew pub and get excited about every new beer style we would offer. But the general public wasn't that engaged until probably the mid-90s. And that's when we opened our Fulton Street Brewery and started distributing. So at that point, I think craft beer had kind of gotten over the first hump, and there were people interested in it. It was still tough to get distribution, though, because a lot of people would only want to devote one or two of their tap handles to craft beer. And then I think in the late 90s is when the tap handle growth really started to explode.
And do you think that was the important thing? Because, I mean, the distribution has always been an interesting part of this equation, right, Greg? I think that's changed a lot in recent years. But how important was distribution in the beginning?
Well, distribution's everything. You know, whether you're in the beer business or the cider business, as I am now, or in the record business, if you don't have a way to get your product to your customers, you don't have customers. So when we started out, we were just a brew pub, and we didn't distribute at all. Then we started self-distributing, and I'd be, you know, making the beer in the morning and then distributing it to accounts like Sheffield's and Shaw's Crab House and an old place called Artful Dodger were some of our first accounts, distributing to them in the afternoon. And then we got into distribution with a wine wholesaler, spirits wholesaler, because frankly, in the 90s, none of the beer wholesalers were interested in a small local craft brewer. So distribution's really, you know, obviously you have to have a great product, but if you can't get it out into the market to your customers, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good.
I'm talking craft beer with Greg Hall. He's the co-founder of Virtue Cider, former brewmaster at Goose Island Brewing Company. We're talking about craft beers throughout Illinois. We'll forgive you that you're joining us from Michigan. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation who's in studio with me. Anthony Benjamin is the brewmaster of Triptych Brewing. He's the co-founder. He's based in Savoy, just south of the Champaign-Urbana area. Triptych opened in 2013, won a silver medal at the World Beer Cup in 2014. Hey, Anthony, thanks for being here, too.
Thanks for having me.
Anthony, what got you started brewing?
I moved into this area for my wife to go to law school originally, and while she was going to law school, that took a lot of her time up, and so I needed something to do, and I found out there was a homebrewing club here on campus at the U of I, and that really kind of got me interested, and I, you know, thought over time, once she started practicing law, there was a possibility that I could maybe do this as a business. So in 2009, I won the Midwest Homebrewer of the Year competition. I had won a lot of medals and ribbons and things, and so it just seemed like maybe this was a possibility. So I found some friends that were into it, and we started a brewery, basically. I mean, it sounds simple, but it was a lot more.
Was it a little more complicated than that?
Yeah, I mean, especially for us, we had a lot of weird dreams and ideas about it. And when we started massively undercapitalized, it was all kinds of, you know, I mean, I think there's lots of different steps where we could have gone the other direction, but.
You know, Greg, as we're listening to Anthony talk about this, I mean, it's sort of, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Virtue Cider and how Virtue Cider came about, because it's, I imagine you had pretty similar sensibility after you left Goose Island into what went into Virtue Cider.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, getting in the cider business was in 2011 was very much like being in craft beer or brewing back in the late 80s, early 90s. It was kind of maybe a little ahead of popular sentiment. So it's kind of starting all over again. But it's exciting to be in cider because I get to work not only with great people on the account side, but also we get to source our apples locally up here in Michigan. Michigan is the second or third largest apple growing state year to year, and it's got a great history of growing apples on the cider coast up and down the coast of Lake Michigan, where there is a rain shed from coming from the lake by 50 miles in. That's very similar to the coast of Normandy and Brittany and Somerset in England, where you get a lot of rain, and that's what apple trees need to thrive, about 40 inches of rain a year. We got a lot last weekend. But it is nice being up here because I get to buy fruit from my neighbors.
That's great. And I wonder, Anthony, as you know, as Greg's talking about this and local ingredients, how important is it for you guys with Triptych? You know, we were asking people to suggest, we've been asking people for a while to sort of suggest their favorite places. And people were telling me about different breweries that throughout Southern Illinois and Central Illinois using how important it is to be using sort of local ingredients in the beer. Is that an important thing for you guys too?
Yeah, it is. Actually, ironically, a couple weekends ago, we had the innovation team from Goose Island here in Champaign County to brew a collaboration beer with us. And one of the ingredients we actually used was Curtis Orchard apple cider. So most of their cider is pressed from local apples. When we can and when it makes sense, we'll use local ingredients. You know, the infrastructure that Greg is talking about hasn't quite reached, you know, the Midwest in terms of barley and hops. I mean, it's getting there. But for us, like, the quality of beer is paramount. And so we won't use a local ingredient if it makes the beer itself inferior. But when we can, I mean, we've used local honey, cider, I have all kinds of different fruits, herbs. There's been, you know, tons of different things where people have had an idea and they bring something in and we end up making a beer with it. We've made peach beer several times now from peaches from Prairie Fruit Farms. And so it's on our mind whenever it makes sense. There's just not a lot of, you know, the core ingredients in beer being barley and hops. There's not a lot of opportunity around here yet.
Yeah, and I know Holly on Facebook said Scratch Brewing Company in Ava uses local ingredients. She said they make really unique beers. Greg, how much of the craft beer movement you think is tied into just the wider movement for local food and people taking a lot more interest and wanting to have ingredients that are, you know, certainly here in Illinois or Midwestern or even more local than that? How much do you think craft beer has sort of come up alongside of that?
Well, I think you're very perceptive on that. You know, we're really, I think, in the age of provenance, where the source of what you're eating or drinking is so important. Wine's always really been sold like that. But now when you walk into a better coffee shop, you know, a lot of people order their coffee by origin, and you used to pay 50 cents for a chocolate bar. Now it's 10 bucks because it comes from Costa Rica. So people, I think, are really interested in that. And it kind of also reverts to that kind of maker culture where you want to know the person who makes your, whether it's your handbag or your chair or table or furniture or whatever. So combining that kind of source of food culture with the maker culture, you get craft beer and cider, and that's something that everybody can relate to. And while you don't buy a table that often, you're probably buying beer every weekend, if not more often. So you can really kind of vote local with your pocket and your palate by supporting a local brewery or craft cidery.
Yeah, I want to ask both of you guys. Greg, I'll start with you. How much more varied do you think beer flavors are now compared to, say, 10 or 20 years ago? Greg?
Oh, yeah, completely. When I first started going out to the Great American Beer Festival, I think there were probably 20 categories. And now there's what, like 113? Is that right, Anthony?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah. Some of the newest ones are. So, I mean, some of the newest things are, you know, session IPAs and lower alcohol beers. And I mean, there's a lot of kind of the categories are getting bigger and bigger. And so it's forcing them to get split into multiple subcategories.
And I guess what you guys are really talking about is really as it's almost like a customer palette that's also really matured. Would you say that, and I'm curious, Greg, I wonder if you can answer first. Do you think that this is driven by customer demand or do you think this is part of the industry also putting this forward?
Well, I think the customers demand more of what they like. And I think it's the brewers, young brewers like Anthony, who innovate and bring out new products. And, you know, some of the styles that you see regularly on the shelf today, I would have never dreamed of brewing 20 years ago, whether it's a fruit IPA or a Goza, you know, or many different styles. You know, there's Imperial just about everything today, with loads of hops in there.
Is that what that means? Is that what it means if you say Imperial?
You know, I think generally means bigger and hoppier.
Ah, so okay.
More alcohol, more hops.
Okay.
So it means intensity. Mm. You know, and I think that's one thing that the drinkers go on that pathway. They start off drinking kind of your domestic canned lager, you know, when they're a little younger, and then they, you know, most people stay that way. You know, still 80% of the drinkers are still drinking pale lager, but the ones who switch generally don't switch subtly. They kind of go from one extreme to the other. And I see a lot of people going straight toward the big hoppy ales, and they go for the intensity of an IPA. And then I think they and some people stay there forever, but then they go more toward complexity. And that's where beer used to always lose drinkers to wine, because there weren't enough complex beers out there. So once a drinker's palate got a little more comfortable with complexity, they left beer and went toward wine, or they went toward wine for occasions like eating. But now, with all the great complex beers out there, Belgian style beers, wild fermented beers, and then same thing with cider, I think you're seeing drinkers stay into the beer and cider category longer than they ever have before, and getting something different out of it, getting complexity.
Oh, thanks for that, Greg. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Virtue Cider's Greg Hall, Triptych's Anthony Benjamin, talking about craft beer throughout Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking craft beers, whether that's Off Color Brewing, Mars Community Brewing, Virtue Cider, Triptych. We have the folks behind Triptych and Virtue Cider on the line with us and in studio with us as we're talking about craft beer. If you want to call in and suggest your favorite craft beer local, we'd like, please, especially Illinois, you can call us 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. You guys have been posting on Facebook and Reddit and Twitter, and we've compiled that list. We've tweeted it out. If you follow 21st Show, we'll have it up at www.21stshow.org after the show, so you can kind of get a list of what everybody we know who's listening to the show is drinking. Anthony Benjamin's in studio with me. Anthony, Greg and I were just talking sort of about flavor profiles. Can you tell us a little bit about Triptych and what you guys have been brewing?
When we first started, and only a few years ago, there wasn't as much local.
Way back in 2013.
Yeah, that's right. There wasn't as much local beer, and so we kind of had a bigger pressure to brew a wider range of styles. We're, you know, our brewery is located in Savoy. We don't have a restaurant. It's just come to the brewery and hang out and taste our beer. And so we felt a lot of pressure to make sure that we could appeal to light lager drinkers and folks who are just getting into craft beer, and at the same time, kind of appeal to the initiated drinker who wants Imperial IPA, who wants, you know, Imperial Stout, things like that. So as a result, at Triptych, I think we've released like 220 different kinds and styles of beer. And so, you know, nowadays, though, we find ourselves focusing in a lot more on the things that we're really interested in and the things that we have kind of learned to do well. Those tend to be English-style beers of a lower gravity, so lower alcohol. You mentioned that we had won a World Beer Cup 2 years ago. And then this year, we won a gold medal at the World Beer Cup for a Session IPA, which is, again, lower alcohol, but a lot of flavor. And so we tend to specialize a lot more on those hoppy beers. You know, when there's more and more breweries opening, believe it or not, it is an advantage that we're here in this community and we can get our beer canned and out at an account, like at a local liquor store, the same day. And there's no brewery in Chicago that's going to be able to send beer, you know, down from Chicago here and have it, you know, here on the same day it was canned. And so that freshness for beer drinkers is increasingly becoming very important.
I wonder if we can talk about the business of it for a minute. How hard was it for you, Anthony, to get this off the ground in terms of capital? How did you guys?
Yeah.
There was Kickstarter. You guys used a lot of different.
Sure. When we first started, it was just three friends who had an idea to open a brewery, and I was leaving the U of I at the time, and Kickstarter was something that was just starting to get hot. And I thought it would be really neat to use it as a project, a way to introduce us to the community. It wasn't really calculated into our capital. The first year or two, we had success, but it was modest. Without capital, without more capital to grow, you're just on this never-ending path of never being able to supply enough beer. And so you're essentially losing sales, you're losing revenue, and you can't add more people, you can't, do any of that. And a lot of that pressure kind of led to our business, me buying out the other partners and then starting over again with new silent partners that brought more capital in. And so this last 2 years have been, we've probably quintupled or even higher in terms of how much beer we're making, how much beer we're selling. I mean, we reach over now to Peoria, Bloomington Normal regularly, where before it was hard to find our beer just in Champaign. It's a very capital-intensive business, and you're sitting there trying to make, profit on a beer where you're making, quarters, or 50 cents at a time. And so, if you want to buy a canning line that costs $215,000, then, the only way to do that is through capital infusions over time.
Greg, as we're listening to Anthony talk about this, the scale of what you were doing with Virtue, did you intend originally when you started Virtue that it would end up being as big as it's become?
Well, when we started, cider was such an afterthought for people. Most people that I told I was leaving Goose Island and starting a cider company, the general response was, oh, that's right. My kids love cider. I put a box in their lunch every day. And I said, oh, no, not that. That's juice.
that's not cider, right.
Beer. And they said, I don't know if you can do that. And I'm like, yeah, yes, you can. So it was, certainly the bartenders and the liquor stores knew about it, but they would generally not have a whole lot to offer. Most bars didn't have any cider back then, and you'd go into a better local Chicago area store like Binny's, and they would have 1,000 different beers,
and then they would have Woodchuck,
5,000 wines,
right?
And they would have 3 ciders. They'd have more varieties of French onion dip than they had cider. And that's crazy. So I thought, there's an opportunity here, but we got to get the word out. And, the timing happened to be very fortunate. We'd been looking at Goose Island at doing cider as far back as 2000. And I think if we would have done it then, it would have been way too early. But with the interest in local foods and more natural foods becoming so big, it became an obvious time for cider to have some success. And then when brands like Angry Orchard and Stella got in and started spending some money on cider to get the word out about the whole category, it was very helpful for us to get that sort of word out without having to spend money on our own.
And Greg, of course, you left Goose Island in 2011 when it was bought by Anheuser-Busch. Last year, you actually sold a majority stake in Virtue to Goose Island. What prompted that?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with just where the market was. So when I left, as I just said, the cider market was tiny. And we didn't have a whole lot of trouble keeping up because there just wasn't that much demand. And then what's happened in the last 5 years is demand has increased so much. We're seeing... we're at the last 3 years, we've been at the Pitchfork Music Festival selling cider, and we would have never dreamed of being some in something like that just back in 2011. We're going to be in all the Jewels, we're going to be in Costco, and there just wasn't demand for that a few years ago. So in order to keep up with that increased demand, we needed more capital, just as Anthony was saying. Anytime you're producing stuff and it's a relatively low margin, you need to have a partner. And, for us, having a partner that could help not only with distribution, but also knew the ins and outs of beer made a whole lot of sense. A lot of people, pretty much everybody in the business, whether you're a brewer or a cider maker, has partners in some respect, and a lot of those partners bring money to the table, but not much else. We felt like partnering with Goose and ABI brings a lot more than just money to the table for us.
That's Greg Hall with Virtue Cider in studio with me, Anthony Benjamin from Triptych. 1-800-222-9455 if you've got a recommendation. Hey, Walter, in Champaign, welcome to the 21st. What's your favorite craft beer?
So I'm a huge fan of Triptych's offering that they've done in collaboration with Prairie Fruit Farms, their Prairie Peach Picnic. Just a wonderful, light, refreshing beer, perfect for this time of year. I'm looking forward to the next incarnation of that.
All right. Thanks for that, Walter. Anthony, we're talking about collaborations. You mentioned you guys did a collaboration earlier this year with Goose Island.
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago, actually. Yeah.
So I wonder, is there a little bit of tension with that, right? Because when we're talking big versus small, bigger companies versus smaller companies, do you feel like that's something where if you work with a bigger company now, the industry has changed so much, people are like, hey, what are you doing?
I think so. But I mean, I think, we did get a little bit of some interesting comments about, you know, our
a little shade.
Yeah, our decision. Yeah, our decision to team up with a brewery that's owned by Anheuser-Busch. I look at it a couple different ways. I mean, one thing I think the big advantage of craft beer is that it's a community. It's not always about being a commodity. And so for me, that means, you know, before we even decided to do the collaboration with Goose, we went up to the Fulton Street facility and hung out with the brewers that we were going to have down here to brew the beer with us, and got to know them and realized, you know, these are normal guys. You know, the corporation, the brewery might be owned by a multinational, you know, huge conglomerate, but these guys are interesting. They're cool. They want to brew good beer. You know, they're innovating at Goose Island, and the big difference between them and us is that they have the money and the capital to do things that we could never dream of doing on our scale. And so for us, it's about learning new things. It's about sharing that passion for craft beer, and these guys still do. And so, you know, that facility and all of the Goose Island facilities still employ a ton of people that are passionate about great beer, and to just, you know, kind of write all that off because of, you know, immediately because of ownership, I think is a problem. You know, over time, though, the community, as we all become more competitive, I think this will be increasingly kind of the attitude is, you know, am I helping a competitor or am I teaming up with a friend? And I mean, even you see that even in local markets, especially in Chicago now, it's becoming a very, very different landscape than it was even, you know, 4 years ago. So it's something that everyone has to kind of bridge when they get there. For us, it made sense. You know, like I said, we learned a lot from what we were doing with them, and it's still important for us to keep learning and keep improving our product. And that means sometimes, you know, turning to the bigger breweries that have way, way more experience than we have.
Mm-hmm. Greg, what are your thoughts on what Anthony's saying, especially as we're seeing, you know, we started this whole conversation saying the amount of craft breweries in Illinois has tripled in the past 4 years. I think a little bit of what Anthony's talking about maybe is inevitable.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I think Anthony takes a very enlightened view. You know, I always find that it's find it somewhat comical when a brewery sells a small independent brewery sells to a bigger brewery, and then somebody posts on Facebook, "I only support small local businesses." Well, Facebook's probably not that small and local, and the computer that they typed it on probably isn't small and local. So people tend to have a different standard for their beer. And I think that's great. I think it's great that beer can fulfill that local product bit. And I think that, you know, the other thing that's just true is that access to capital. So, you know, if you're gonna grow your business and you need more money, you know, you can get it from a banker or a private equity guy who doesn't know anything about making or selling or marketing beer. Or you can get it from a brewer who has spent their whole careers brewing, marketing, and selling beer. So, you know, I think that's kind of the way we looked at it. And, you know, when you have people like Lagunitas who were, you know, kind of one of the biggest haters in when the Goose deal went down, them doing their deal with Heineken, you know, everybody kind of sees, I think, eventually that, hey, it's actually a pretty good way to not only source capital, but also be involved with other people, just as Anthony wants to learn more from Goose Island. The Goose Island people have learned a ton from AB. You know, they've got some of the best engineers, chemists, microbiologists in the world working in their breweries. So So, you know, I think we all can learn from each other in that respect.
Hey, Greg, we got a question on Twitter from Adam. He wants to know when you guys are going to be back in New Jersey for distribution.
We will be back in September, very soon.
All right. There you go,
so
Adam.
Sometime next, we're actually opening up. The fall is kind of cider season, when people are used to going off to the orchards and picking apples. I know, Nyla, you went to Michigan up. You went to school up in Michigan.
I did. So I know in that Grand Rapids area.
When you're up here?
You know, I didn't. So I need to come to Fenville and pick apples.
That would be great. That would be great.
It is a great.
Wonderful. Has those wonderful memories of picking apples in the fall. So it's a perfect time for us to kind of get our cider out there. So that's the time we get into some of the new markets.
If we've got Walter still on the line, I just want to bring him back up, our caller. He wanted to add something about Triptych. Hey, Walter, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So you said you grew up in the area where Triptych is now located. What did you want to add about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up right around the corner from where Triptych is now on South 45. And for a while, the business area that they're in, so it had seen better days. And when Triptych came into that area, I think it's no coincidence that that area has since been revitalized significantly. So I've seen firsthand a really positive economic impact to having a local brewer in the neighborhood, people committed to that business, and then other businesses piggybacking on that success. So I want to thank Anthony and Triptych for not only beautifying the neighborhood, but also bringing some wonderful local products.
It's our pleasure.
Thanks for that call, Walter. Greg, you know, I wanted to ask you about that, about economic impact, to Walter's point. I mean, do you have any sense of what you think the impact the craft beer industry has had on Illinois economically?
You know, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I'm sorry I don't. But, you know, if you look at 100 and...
Oh, Anthony brought him, actually. Go ahead, Anthony. Anthony brought him. He's got his...
So according to the Brewers Association, right now, Illinois craft beer generates about $1.4 billion in overall money, which then generates taxes of approximately $450 million that go back into the state coffers.
We've got about a minute left, and I wanted to ask both of you, Anthony, let me start with you really quickly. What do you think? What's next? What's next for you guys with Triptych?
It's funny that Walter mentioned that, because we always kind of thought that we could keep maybe getting more property where we're at in Savoy right now and expand down that street. But we have kind of increased the value to beyond what a manufacturing facility can pay for land. So we're currently kind of looking for our next step.
Are you guys getting priced out of your neighborhood now? Is that what you're saying?
We own our building,
okay,
but we don't own any other adjacent
okay
properties. And so, yeah, we're priced out of buying any adjacent property. So we're kind of working with the village of Savoy and trying to figure out what our next step is and where we're going to go from here.
Greg, what do you think's next for cider, for craft beer? What would you like to see next?
Well, you know, people ask me all the time if we're reaching a saturation point. And I ask them, well, you know, if there's 156 breweries in Illinois, how many bank branches are in Chicago? Probably four times that. So I think as long as brewers are comfortable opening up smaller places and being a little bit more dedicated to the neighborhood or a smaller area, which it sounds like what Anthony's done, I think there is room for a lot. There's probably not room for another 1,000 Sierra Nevadas out there, but small brewers, the more the merrier. You know, I think that's a great thing, a great change that's happened in the last generation.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
One just about on every corner, it seems.
Thanks. Greg Halls, the founder of Virtue Cider. Thanks also to Anthony Benjamin from Triptych. We've got all of the information online at 21stshow.org. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For the millions of people who suffer from serious allergies, epinephrine can be a lifesaver. The drug is easily administered with an auto-injector device known by its brand name, EpiPen. The problem is that the cost of EpiPens have skyrocketed in recent years. Since 2004, the price has increased more than fivefold, from roughly $100 to more than $600, according to a report from Stat News. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with a doctor and hear how families are coping with the price increase. But first, new legislation signed into law last week will make it possible for fire and rescue departments to save millions of dollars a year by allowing emergency medical personnel to administer epinephrine using a vial and a syringe instead of the EpiPen. We're joined now by State Senator Chapin Rose. He's a Republican representing Mahomet, and he sponsored the bill. Senator Rose, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What's this new law about?
So it gets very much the heart of your lead-in, which is that the costs have skyrocketed on EpiPens. And, you know, it's not just food allergies. It could be bee stings. It could be all kinds of things. And I used to be an EMT a long time ago in a different life. And anaphylactic shock is very serious. And oftentimes, you don't even know you're allergic. I mean, you might have been stung by a bee before or once or twice. And it's that third or fourth one that'll actually get you and put you in anaphylactic shock. So you may be, you know, out to lunch somewhere and don't realize that the food oils that are being used might have peanuts in them. So it can be very serious. It can be very deadly. And particularly for rural downstate Illinois, it is a time issue. You've got to get that epinephrine very quickly. And if you're a rural downstate, it might take 25, 30, even 40 minutes to actually get to the emergency room. And time is not on your side when you're suffering from severe reaction. So our Broadlands Longview Fire Department contacted me and said, hey, you know, we can do this same life-saving medicine. We're spending $2,400 a year on it right now. If we could do it with a vial and a syringe, it would cost about $50 a year. Now think about what I just said there.
Wow. So repeat that for everybody. $2,400 a year versus how much?
$50. So that's a huge savings for the Broadlands Longview Fire Department. But then take that savings times the whole state of Illinois. And I'll tell you what, I think the EpiPen manufacturer has made a huge mistake, because with Governor Rauner signing this legislation Friday, they just lost a major customer, because every EMS department in the state of Illinois is going to switch to the vial and the syringe. And that's you think about how many EpiPens are in the Champaign-Urbana Fire Department any given day of the week when they're out running calls. If you think about how many EpiPens there are, you know, in downtown Illinois with all these rural fire departments that have got one in every bag. And now we're going to be doing a vial and syringe for far, far cheaper. So it's most importantly going to make sure that we maintain a level of service, of life-saving service to our constituents. But we're also going to save the taxpayer a heck of a lot of money in the process.
Senator Rose, as you mentioned, the price of EpiPen, and we're going to talk about this more in a few minutes, but I know that your counterparts at the federal level are saying that these prices are outrageous and that they hurt families who need the drug to protect their kids. Would you support efforts to curb the price of the drug for families and for people outside of being?
So what I'm told, it's really interesting, because we introduced this legislation, you know, 9 months ago. And it was signed in the law last Friday, and it sort of hit coincidentally with all this other national media that's come along with these price spikes at the federal level that have now been discussed. So I think it's good that it's being talked about, because a lot of families do care. My family carries an EpiPen on a regular basis. So a lot of families, you know, have this to protect themselves, and it's a cost for them. But I think my opinion is there's a opportunity here in the near future to save big money, because I think the federal government, the FDA, is apparently in trials for to allow people to auto-inject appropriately dosed ampules, and that's the big issue right now. I mean, the nice thing about the EpiPen is you're auto-injecting the correct dose for you. Are you an adult or are you a child, right? And misdosing could kill you. So, you know, the first rule is, you know, do no harm. You don't want to accidentally kill your patient trying to save your patient. So the dosing is absolutely critical to this. But I understand that there is right now an FDA process, essentially ampules that would be dose specific that a physician could prescribe. And then you could go ahead and inject yourself with a simple syringe, which doing that would bring the prices down for everyone.
Yeah, it definitely would. And I wanted to ask you just one last question about this, Senator Rose. Not everyone has the benefit of your EMT training, but I understand that there are, as you mentioned, some risks associated with administering epinephrine with a vial and a syringe, whether that's contamination or accidentally administering the wrong dose. How much did you all consider those health risks and the idea that it needs to be a professional doing this when you were considering drafting the legislation?
So the legislation requires the Illinois Department of Public Health to create a training course for our EMTs to do this, and before they're given this authority. So training is a critical component of it. And they will have to be trained appropriately so that this is dosed correctly so we can take care of that patient.
That was Senator Chapin Rose of Mahomet. He sponsored the bill, now law, that will allow fire and rescue departments throughout Illinois to save millions of dollars a year on epinephrine. Senator Rose, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're joined now by Dr. Sindhura Bondi. She's an assistant professor of allergy and immunology at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, here to explain a little bit more about the rising cost of EpiPens. Dr. Bondi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you can explain the costs of why the EpiPen. I mean, we were earlier citing statistics from Stat News. There was an article in Forbes saying that it was about rising from about $57 to more than $600. I've heard even as high as $900. Dr. Bondi, what do we know about why EpiPen costs have risen so sharply in recent years?
I think there's a couple factors that go into it, but the most sort of prominent factor of recent has been the fact that there really isn't a comparable product on the market. The previous comparable market went off the market, was recalled because of issues with dosing and miscalibrations with the dosing. And the other sort of options are one other option called Adrenaclick. However, it doesn't seem to be common practice among a lot of allergists or pediatricians to prescribe it, and it's not as readily available at all pharmacies the way that EpiPen is. And in addition, there seems to be some of the same issues that plague the EpiPen with insurance coverage, meeting your deductible with the Adrenaclick. And then the option of using the syringe and the ampule isn't really something that is predominant right now because it would take a lot of education on the part of a physician to make sure that the patient was getting the appropriate dose and using it appropriately.
Right. In fact, we got a call from a mom, Nicole in Schaumburg. First, before I play what Nicole was going to say, because it was about that dosing, I just want to ask you about the price, because Nicole told us that on her most recent visit to the drugstore, she paid $370 for a 2-pack of EpiPens for her 2-year-old son. He has severe food allergies. That's with her husband's insurance. What have you been hearing from families about how they're coping with these costs?
I absolutely believe it because I've been seeing that with a lot of our patients as well. The drug manufacturer has been trying to make amends by having coupons online and other sort of options.
Oh, and that was with a $100 coupon, the $370 price, by the way.
Correct. So there are caveats to all those coupons. So they have to meet their deductible or they have to have a certain type of insurance. And families have to remember that a 2-pack is supposed to be in the same place. It's not that one 2-pack has to go to one has to go to school and one has to stay at work. The entire 2-pack has to stay in the same place to protect against possible delayed reactions.
Oh,
so most families are purchasing actually 4 EpiPens for one patient because maybe one for school and one for home, or one for work, one for home.
Right, or one has to be left to daycare or things like that, right?
Exactly. Mm. So while it may be $350 for a 2-pack, in actuality, many are purchasing 2 2-packs for one patient.
And I wanted to get back to that issue of, you know, when we heard Senator Rose talking about EMTs and having qualified EMTs administer doses via syringe, Nicole said that this was something that she considered, but she ultimately decided against it.
In part because my son is really young and the concern of overdosing him is much higher because he is so young and so small. Also, because he tends to be relatively fidgety and squirmy, the concept of an auto-injector is definitely easier. And also, because he goes to my mom's to be watched or to preschool or to church nursery or to a number of different places where there are other adults who are in charge of his care and would potentially have to respond in an emergency situation, it's been in some ways difficult enough to explain, here's an EpiPen and how you use it and what you should look for. And the thought of having to explain, okay, here's a syringe and here's how you would use this in case of an emergency just adds a level of difficulty that I certainly wouldn't be comfortable asking someone else who's caring for my son to have to kind of undertake as part of his care.
Dr. Bondi, I wanted to ask you about that because I personally have been freaked out at the idea of even having to administer an EpiPen for my niece and nephews. I know people have said, just practice on a grapefruit, you know, but even just the EpiPen itself, I know personally scares me. But I wanted to ask you, as a medical professional, do you think that it's a good idea for families to choosing to buy syringes and vials of epinephrine to administer the drug manually?
I think at this point, it's really hard to say because it's not part of our routine teaching for patients. I do know that even though we go through extensive teaching in using the EpiPen, administering it correctly, using a trainer, at the heat of the moment, if your child is having an anaphylactic reaction, it's most natural to be nervous and to forget sometimes how to administer it properly. So even with the EpiPen, we see issues with the way that it's injected, maybe incorrect usage. So I can only imagine that that would be substantially more in a more difficult device delivery system such as an ampule and a syringe. And I think it puts a lot of pressure on a patient and their parents to be able to have to administer it in that fashion. So definitely if this paradigm shift were to happen and we would start using the ampules because the EpiPen costs, you know, continue to skyrocket, then we're really going to have to spend a lot of time teaching our patients and also reassuring them on the use.
Are you familiar with what Senator Rose talked about, the possibility of the FDA approving vials that are single dose in the same way as an auto injector? Because I know right now there's the EpiPen Junior and then there's the EpiPen. So certainly the manufacturer is already producing the amount of dose for a child and for adult already. So are you familiar with any of that?
I've heard about it because they've also talked about single dose use for, you know, crash carts and things like that as well. I think that would ease some of the administration concerns, but there are still some increased, you know, chances for operator error with the ampule and syringe.
I know that you mentioned this before, that the EpiPen isn't the only epinephrine injector available on the market. There is a generic. You've been talking about coupons. Is the generic covered by most insurance plans?
I have had a few patients who have it, and it was not completely covered. The out-of-pocket cost was about $100 to $150, but it was still substantially less than the EpiPen, which is why that was a viable option for them. They did mention that the device was a little bit harder to use than the EpiPen.
Mm. And besides it being harder to use, do you have other opinions on how the generic option compares to the name brand EpiPen?
Other than that, it appears to be the same dosing and the same medication.
So as we were talking about this, Dr. Bandy, what's your advice for families grappling with this right now? I mean, it's something where obviously, as you're saying, families need not just one, but probably multiple packs because you can't split the pack up. So we're talking about, you know, anywhere from $500 to $1,000 in drug costs. And correct me if I'm wrong, the EpiPen, it lasts a year, right? Do they need to be replaced every year?
Correct.
Whether or not they're used?
Correct.
What's your advice for families?
I think the one biggest advice is to make sure to let your provider know about the cost. The majority of my patients, I don't even know that they're walking around with expired EpiPens or that there was such a high out-of-pocket cost because they never let me know. And then I come to find out on follow-up that they haven't had an EpiPen for this entire time. Not that we may necessarily be able to do anything about it, but even if there's, you know, some chance that we may be able to provide assistance in directing the patient in the right way will be helpful.
And,
because the scariest thing is not having anything at all.
Well, and two quick questions on that. First of all, Mylan, who's the drug company, there are possibilities for ways for people to get free EpiPens, correct?
Correct. Unfortunately, though, now, I don't know if they've changed it now that all this press is out, but when I tried 6 months ago, they could not have insurance at all.
Oh, so if you didn't
have,
okay.
But I do know that there have been some changes with all of this being publicized more recently, so hopefully they're moving towards a good direction there.
And Dr. Bandy, one last question about an expired pen. Is that something that that's something that then has a possibility of not working if a family has an expired EpiPen with them?
Correct.
Okay. So thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Sandhura Bandy is an assistant professor of allergy and immunology at Rush University Medical Center, where she joins us from there in Chicago. Dr. Bandy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today on the 21st. Tomorrow we're going to be discussing veterans courts. That's a diversion program for nonviolent veterans who get in trouble with the law and lawmakers' efforts to make them mandatory throughout Illinois. Thanks to everyone who called, tweeted, posted on Facebook and Reddit for our earlier conversation about craft beers in Illinois. We've got a list of everyone's recommendations. We crowdsource them. They're up at our website at www.21stshow.org. That's where you can give us feedback as well. Follow us on Twitter too. It's 21st Show, 21st Show. That's where we tweeted out all of those links as well. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.